So we just chanted Sri Aurobindo's Gayatri along with a number of other Vedic chants coming from that lengthy tradition stretching back into times immemorial, recalling to us the famous Gayatri mantra that occurs in the Rig Veda. And we began this long prelude to the study of Sri Aurobindo's magnum opus, The Life Divine, with a first entrance into the Rig Veda. And from there, through the rest of the length of India's long spiritual history, at least we touched upon the high points. And we saw when we looked at the Rig Veda, which is hard to date, maybe it's as close to us as 1500 BCE, maybe it's as far back as 5000 BCE. We don't have the means of dating it accurately at this point. At least some portions of it are old beyond reckoning. When we look at the Rig Veda, we find in it a way the human spirit looks to conduce itself with the universe and with the powers, conscious and otherwise, that populate the universe. Central to the life of the Indian living according to Brahmanical rules was the institution of the sacrifice, the yajna. And you can well imagine the vedi, the altar of the sacrifice, the fire upon the altar. But remember that all of it was a reflection of something that in their cosmological thinking had root above, that there was an original sacrifice in which the divine being submitted itself to the ritual of yajna, and it was itself divided into many parts and offered in a fire, so that the world and the multitude of existence could come into being. And as that begins the universe continues when the human makes a similar sacrifice, an offering back. The divine makes the first offering, comes to us, we come into being as parts of his being, and then we ascend into unification with that being through the implementation of the sacrifice. But not only that, the cosmic order is created and sustained and recreated and sustained again through observing the ritual, that the ritual has power. The ritual is not simply a physical act, of course. There's a mantra that gives vision to it, and the mantra comes to the ritual by way of the inspired seer, the Rishi, who within his own being has a vision which is concentrated upon. And when it comes into maturity, it is vocalized. And that vocalization becomes the mantra, becomes the Rik. And when the ritual is enacted and the mantra is spoken, then the fire takes the offering upwards and calls back that corresponding conscious power to move into conflation with the one who offers. So there is a round of existence that is secured. There is a commerce between the divine and the human There is an order given to our lives individually and collectively. The world is sustained, and the divine is happy with our offering. Note that to Vedic life, there is no calling away to an other life. This life is meant to be rich, is meant to be fulfilling, is meant to become divine. There is no idea of shedding the body. Well, off at some distance from the Vedic life are some rishis who are munis, who are sages who live a rather wild life out in the woods, out on the mountains. They're clad only in the wind, and perhaps in those clusters we find the beginnings of a life of renunciation, but the Vedic life proper is not one of renunciation, but one of life's fulfillment. The divine is here, and you are meant to live an ordered, wealthy, and prosperous life in communion with the divine. And the larger the being you are, the more aspects of the divine crowd into you. So Indra, representing the divine mind. Vayu, representing the divine life force. Agni, himself the mystic fire, has his home inside you. Varuna, the oceanic being of the wide consciousness. Surya, the home of the sun, the solar truth. Aditi, she who gives birth to everything, the infinite mother goddess. All of these are within the experience of the one who offers himself. The items, the grain, the ghee, all represent aspects of our being, but they're outer symbols. To the one who really understands the nature of the sacrifice, there's an inner dimension to the mantra, there's an inner dimension to the ritual, and he becomes the real initiate. The rishi can speak to him and say, this is what I meant when I said that mantra. They understand it in one way, the common laity. But you, my friend, my fellow seeker, this is its real significance. And so there's an outer and an inner meaning to the Veda. Thousands of years later, when Sri Aurobindo came to pick up the Veda, he recognized in it his own spiritual experiences expressed in Vedic speech. He had never read the Veda before, but could see that these archaic images and transfers of energy back and forth were part and parcel of his yogic development, which gave him a unique insight into how to scan the Veda and interpret it and make it come alive again to us. So the Veda began our review, naturally, of India's spiritual life. And the cream of the Veda, if you like to put it that way, is the Vedanta, what comes at the end of the Veda. And literally, the Veda debouches finally into the Upanishads, these secret teachings which were spread in numbers of hermitages, we'll say, across the northern part of India, from the Kuru Panchala area all the way into the Gangetic Plain. And when we looked at these Upanishads, the Isha, Brihadaranyaka, the Katha, Taittiriya, we saw that not one of them was interested in renouncing the world. The Upanishadic sages may have lived just outside the cities, in nice bucolic areas, and princes and others might have come and visited them in sort of a retreat setting. But if you look at the teachings, these sages were never calling those people away from their life, from their duties in the world, but rather imparting into them teachings which could uplift their experience, which could explain what had become the empty, lost meaning of the Rig Veda in ways that could come alive for them. So, many have liked to say the Upanishads had one teaching. The Upanishads had many teachings. But there is a common theme running through it, just as when in the Veda we meet the idea that there is one divine which has many facets. In the Upanishads, we find that concept somewhat reversed. All the facets of the universe reveal the divine. The many are the one. And when you look into yourself, the self that you are really is not the mere physical shell that you inhabit, not the body, but there is in you an immortal spirit, a true self, which is one with this wider existence. Not simply the universal existence, not just simply the world, but something which transcends the world. We begin to come now in the Upanishads to a recognition that this reality is beyond all categorization, beyond the measure of time, beyond the periodicities of the Vedic calendar, beyond the mind, beyond the emotions, beyond the body, and yet here intimate to all of it as well. It's in the bird and the beast and the mountain. It's above us, it's below us, it's around us. This world is all an expressive manifestation of something that continually expands, Brahman. So where Brahman simply means the creative word in the Rig Veda, by the time we get to the Upanishads, it represents the divine being itself. And in the Isha, we saw that that reality is seen not simply as an existence, but also as a being. All this is for the habitation of the Lord. Isha means Lord. So a personal divinity who stands within us as a universe moving in the universe, and if we live in concert with that larger being, then we lose our egoity. Doesn't mean ego disappears, but it means our fixation upon the ego, our fixation upon, quote, our desires, is loosened, and we see the divine fulfilling itself all over the place. When we back up and look, we say, ah. And that wonderful exclamation is there in the Isha. It appears later in the Kena Upanishad, where it is simply called the ah experience. The Taittiriya, which we could call the Bliss Upanishad, because it's so much focused upon Ananda as the creative power of the world, makes that its rallying cry again and again in its verses. And in the end, the one who has this vision of Ananda being the birth the sustenance and the dissolution of all things, is free to move through all the worlds, singing from that state of rapture. So the Upanishads are most affirmative. They're saying yes to reality. You may not be able to measure it, but it is. So, as we looked at the Upanishads, we then came to look closely thereafter at a number of disciplines, all of which rejected the Vedic orientation and stand apart as, quote, unorthodox systems, Shramanic systems. Shrama, which means to exert oneself. And the term is applied especially to those who were Buddhist or Jain, or the Ajivikas also were included in that group. Buddha and Mahavira, the founders of Buddhism and Jainism, the closest historical personages, both lived in the same area of India, not very far away from each other, in the Gangetic Plain. Buddha was probably born in what is now Nepal, the son of a king, but likely as not, that kingdom was ruled by an oligarchic group that elected their king. So whether Buddha would have been king after his father's passing or divestiture is open to question. But all the fiefdoms, the kingdoms in that part of India followed a different idea of kingship than those a little to the west and north in the Kuru Panchala area, where the Rig Veda and Brahmanical life was dominant. In the Vedic culture, the king was a power, and especially a martial power, because the sacred word and the sacred teachings rested in the hands and the laps of the Brahmin class, the upper class, the class of priesthood, who did the rituals, who made the offerings. But as that Vedic culture came eastwards and began to penetrate this Gangetic Plain, it met some resistance because the kings there believed that they themselves were wise. And there is a long tradition in India of the royal sage. Janaka is one such. Buddha apparently came from that kind of lineage, which resisted Brahmanical rule, didn't think that they were wiser, did not accept their teaching. What is interesting is that the Buddha in exploring other spiritual paths, having left his kingdom, his wife, and his son behind, eventually alights upon a teaching which becomes closely identified with him, the Sankhya teaching, where all in the material, the vital, the mental world is seen as the play of nature, with various constituents to that nature shifting constantly. In the Sankhya teaching, behind all the play of nature is a conscious being, a Purusha, who watches. Buddha accepts the theory of Prakriti, basically, but does not accept the concept of Purusha. So in some ways you could say that the teaching of Buddhism, at least to that extent, in terms of its cosmology, is Sankhya minus Purusha. Why would the Buddha, Gautama, be friendly to this teaching? Interestingly, the originator of this Sankhya, the word means enumeration, by the way, philosophy, was Kapila, who was a non-Vedic sage, seen by Vedic peoples as being an asura. But now we see, not only in Buddhism, but in several Upanishads also, this idea of the Sankhyan analysis of nature entering into the philosophy of India and rolls along for centuries. We're still working with that philosophy today. Sri Aurobindo makes constant reference to Sankhyan terminology in enunciating his vision in the life divine. So, Buddha made use of Sankhya, but offered a quick analysis. If this is what you really are, this bag of skin filled with stuff, then why are you getting so upset about it? You know it had a beginning, you know it's going to have an end, and striving to gain something from it will lead you to suffering, must inevitably lead you to that. And so, if you will give up this idea of a false self, this fictional being that you think exists, you can rid yourself of suffering. What is on the other side, I call nirvana. What it is, I cannot explain to you. Will you answer questions about God, Buddha? No. Will you answer questions about the beginning of the universe, Buddha? No. Those answers would not edify anything. And not edifying would waste our time. I can show you a route by which you get out of this. I have developed what I call the Noble Fourfold Path, the Four Noble Truths. And Buddha was an extraordinary psychologist. It is not that he disagreed with the teachings of the Upanishads, not their core insights. He seems to have known the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad pretty well, not in the form that we have it now, but he knew some of its teachings, and he was ingenious in that when you take an ordinary term, Buddha will let you use that term, but he will flip it over and give it a different meaning. And in so assigning a different meaning, change the way that you look at things. And in that way, be able to convince you that your previous conviction was erroneous, using simple imagery. The idea that we are what we are and must always be, he compared, for instance, with the nature of a cart. Take this cart over here. If you take off its wheels and its axles and set them all aside, where is that cart? Where is that cart gone? And if you take the human and divest it of its mind and its emotions and its body, where has that human gone? Where has that self gone? It doesn't answer the question, what's on the other side? What is the nature of nirvana? But if you drop this idea of a false self, then you are released from false expectation and can experience reality as it is. Experiencing reality as it is was also the goal of the Upanishads. So, the Buddha was far more interested in taking that original insight and then saying, let us meditate. Here, he differs a little from the Jain tradition, which was similar in many respects. Both are traditions of renunciation. To be a true Buddhist means to renounce the world and wear the orange robe. The Jain also renounced the world. Both paths wanted to cease harming other things, to practice ahimsa, non-harmfulness. The Jain wanted to do that extremely by refusing to move, refusing to eat, and even fasting unto death in the most heroic. But Buddhism said it is a middle path that we have to tread. We have to cease harming not only in physical act, but in thought, in feeling, and simply stopping motility will not change things, but changing your consciousness will change you and the world. In other words, there is some interpenetration of an awakened being whose power in the universe has an effect for good and awakens others. And so the Buddha taught meditation. And meditation was not absent from earlier traditions, certainly was present in the Upanishadic age, but Buddha took it into new and powerful directions. Buddhism became powerful in India by dwelling close to cities. There is no evidence that Buddhism ever penetrated into the rural areas of India. It was not accepted there. But Buddha was himself from royalty, and there is plenty of evidence that the people who were first drawn to him were wealthy urbanites, whether they came from royal families or from mercantile groups. Buddha happened to come along at a point when there was an agricultural revolution in that part of India. And for once, the farmers, the Vaishyas, who grew the food, had more grain than they knew what to do with. They could trade with it. They could have wealth from it. Not accepting Brahmanical authority, the wealth did not automatically belong to the Kshatriyas and the Brahmins. So they could do something else. Interestingly, the Buddhists said, "Hail, fellow, well met. Can we travel with you? Can we go with you and get safe conduct from one place to the other?" And in that way, Buddhism spread from town to town, from urban center to urban center, bringing their ideas along with the grain. And in this way, became a real presence. Chandragupta Maurya was not a Buddhist, he was a Jain. But his grandson, Ashoka, became a Buddhist after having slaughtered God knows how many people in what we now call Orissa. But he made Buddhism the state religion in much the same way that Constantine made Christianity the one state religion that unified all the Western world. And in that way, Christianity leapfrogged over all the old faiths of Europe. And in this way, at least in seats of power, Buddhism became a real player. Jainism also was frequently present in ruling situations, and so received lots of state money. Both these paths, Jainism and Buddhism, have a strong lay following in urban areas, but those who are most sincere among them have renounced the world. When we return to the Vedantic tradition, we find next a new and powerful expression which is rooted in the great national epic, the Mahabharata, a teaching which again addresses life, and that is the Bhagavad Gita. And the Gita looks at Arjuna's quandary on the field of Kurukshetra, where, confronted with the idea that he has to kill his kinsmen and his teachers, he's revolted and wants to run from that battle into the state of sannyasa, but asks Krishna's counsel, who immediately says, pick up your bow and fight. You are a born kshatriya, and you know this is your duty. You know that the soul in us cannot be destroyed, is immortal in its very nature, and that if you abandon the field, only ill can come of it. And then unrolls a complete picture of how one can grow in consciousness through the practice of life. Wherever you are, whatever status you have, if you do the work with an inner orientation, treating every act as an opportunity to give, and to give to the divine, then as you undertake such action, your ego dissolves away and you live moved by the divine will and growing ever more conscious of a communion with the divine being. But this is a union with the divine that does not call you away from the world. That has repercussions in the way that we see the world too. The old cosmology that we had, where one could live a rich spiritual life, or one could live a rich spiritual life, antinomous to each other, the Vedic path being the one, Buddhism the other. When we look at the Gita, this problem is taken up. And Krishna eventually tells him, look, it works like this. The you that you commonly know, Weeks call the Kshara Purusha, that personality which is constantly changing as it moves through the world, Above that is a spiritual, vast, unimpeachable Atman, what we call the Akshara Purusha. And that is what most sages move to when they leave this world and attain moksha. But there is a third status of the personhood, and that is when it rises into communion with the Purushottama, the ultimate person. Because in that ultimate person is the Akshara, is the Kshara, and a supreme nature. So all that seems to be contrary in this divided world is in the nature of the divine person perfectly reconciled, so that the timeless and the time moving are one and the same. Then he reveals his biggest secret. At the very core of you, Arjuna, and of all beings in the world, I stand, the Supreme Person. I stand there, the soul of your soul. I'm the truth of your individuality. And as you move in the world, following the orbit that is natural to your nature, which is a unique expression of my nature, then you come to the ultimate good. And if you can learn to do this in oneness with me through your knowledge, in a complete surrender of your works, and the full fastening of your heart to my heart, then in that profound oneness, you won't need any dharma, you won't need any teaching, any instruction. You need no rule book about how to live life, because I will inspire you moment to moment. And then Arjuna is convinced, picks up his bow, goes back to work, defeats the enemy, and the eternal teaching, which is most present in India, is allowed to continue on. So his heroism was finally not simply that he was the greatest warrior of the age, but that he was able to leave the ordinary stance of the warrior behind and to become a spiritually aware warrior, which all of us can do in whatever job we have. The acts that we undertake can be divinely inspired, and a movement of communion that lifts us into a solid embrace with the Supreme. And when we see a multifarious world, we can begin to recognize behind all the movements and all the people that one universal being. And we can live a life of great beneficence and a life of great benefit to others. Not only will our experience of the world be changed, but such a one moving through the world changes the world. Well, the Vedic became the Vedantic, and the Vedantic continued to move along, and Shankara spoke to us that this perfect being, this Brahman, is a final reality. And the only reality. And in its perfection, it is complete being, consciousness, and bliss. And all that appears other than that is a mistake of the divided consciousness in misperceiving reality as it is, as a man walking in dusk might see a stick on a road and flinch back thinking it's a snake. Just so we look at a multifarious world and fail to see Brahman there instead. Well, Shankara was actually going a step farther than Buddha. If Buddha said, this world is a world of suffering, Shankara said, no, it's a world of illusion. It doesn't really exist. His extreme stance is called Advaita Vedanta, the non-dualistic Vedanta. But it's not the only kind of non-dualism that might exist. We'll set aside Ramanuja for the moment and recall that in the Tantra tradition, which came into being within 100 or 200 years of Shankara, in Kashmir, there was a perspective that the universe is indeed one throughout, but is altogether the divine. Every drop of it is divine. And the imperfections that we see are modalities of a great theatrical play. And that to be able to tear off the disguise and see the pure nature of this supreme being behind is what we should be about in our practice of yoga. And that great being, Abhinavagupta, recognized as Shiva. But a name is a name. Abhinavagupta's non-dualism does something in interpreting the world that Shankara fails to do. Shankara cannot explain the common experience of the world and the man in the world. Abhinavagupta's does. Abhinavagupta is the inheritor of a long tantric tradition which, like the Veda, stretches back far, far in time, but begins as a goddess-oriented force, probably in rural India, that part of India which has been much ignored till now. The cult of the Mahadevi comes indeed from that field and insists upon the reality of the world, that all this world is a manifestation of her being, that she has given birth to it. And all the gods and other goddesses are aspects of her greatness. The Devi Mahatmyam is the earliest record we have of this, probably 400 CE would be a good dating for it. But shortly thereafter, the worship of the goddess begins to take tantric ritual form, and even when the idea of Shiva Shakti is combined with the tantric practice, in actual work, one is dealing with the power of the Shakti. So even when Shiva is given supreme status in some aspects of tantric development, the Shakti is the means by which one, through ritual, through diagram, through mantra, and through kriya, achieves the breakthrough of consciousness, which destroys the ego knot and allows one to release from one's base all the oppressed energy and consciousness into a final assault upon the superconscient, where one arrives in distinct communion with the infinite. In other words, the goddess power, which is at the base of our being, in what we call the Kundalini, is awakened and rushes up the Sushumna channel and attains oneness with the Supreme Abham. So again, Shakti is united with Shiva. And in the same way that spirit and matter marry and are one, no division, so too in our consciousness, there is no division between and among the power of the goddess, the power of the Lord, and the one who experiences their union. So Shiva, Shakti, and Nara are all the same being. So the goddess tradition is made one with the tantric practice in the form of the Sri Vidya Tantra. And this was that brand of tantrism that Sri Kapali Shastriya was initiated into. Just a quick aside, if I can be permitted one. Kapali Shastriya said that he was a tantric through and through. He had made a note about this, made an observation about that. When he left his body in 1953, at that time, Mother had no interest in Tantra. A few years later, she became interested. And there was a pundit from South India, from Rameshwaram, who came to India, came to Pondicherry, and was teaching Mother some tantric practices. One occasion came where she was indrawn and Kapali suddenly appeared to her. And he said, "You never told me you were interested in Tantra. If you had asked, I could have given." And Mother said to him, "Give now." So she said, and then I widened. And like an ocean, Kapali poured all of his knowledge, all of his conscious power into her and became one with her. When Madhav heard that, he was deeply moved because she said that Kapali's teaching was so great that she had to widen to be able to receive it. Note this, too, about Kapali, because he is, in a way, something of a consummation of the long tradition of India. He was fully versed in the Rig Veda, could write an epitome of the Upanishads, the light on the Upanishads, you should go and look at it. He says things you won't find anywhere else, makes revelations which will go unseen if you don't look it up. And was fully siddha in the practice of Tantra. Sat at the feet of Ramana Maharshi, one who realized the self when he was a mere 17 years old. And yet, with all of this in him, could see that Sri Aurobindo was the wave of the future, that this was a sadhana, an integral yoga that aimed at a revolution in the very depths of the universe, that this was a means by which life could be transformed. And so, left all that he had achieved, all those fulfillments, to go and take up Sri Aurobindo's yoga. And though he had the realization of the self, although he was siddha in the practice of tantric yoga in the Sri Vidya system, he followed Mother's directive, who said, realize the psychic being. He asked a handful of questions to Sri Aurobindo. What is the nature of the psychic? 1, 2, 3, 4. Sri Aurobindo wrote him back. He never asked another question. He worked on that and worked on that. And in around a decade's time, had achieved that realization also. So just in the reverse, where many people feel that in the integral yoga, you begin with the psychic and move to the spiritual, and then beyond, for Kapali, he went from the spiritual to the psychic. Realize that. And then stepped into new spheres. We'll talk about that, though. Days, months, and years to come. Back to where we were. I know that we've left untouched the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. That's not fair. We should note that they are a corpus of insights into the nature of the mind, that they chart out the various levels of conscious awareness from the physical up to the transcendental, using again Sankhyan terminology, strongly influenced by Buddhism. The Buddhists were very critical of all things Brahmanical in those days. They don't make a single critique of the Yoga Sutras because they recognize in it what it is. It is an effort to bring Buddhist conscious modeling into the field of what would then become Hinduism. I know also we have not touched upon various other yogic practices, the Kanpata yogis. We had a wonderful occasion recently to be able to talk about bhakti yoga. About bhakti yoga, I would want to say again that the idea that we can participate in the divine being is not exclusively in our emotions. That is a misconveyance of what bhakti aims at. Bhakti aims at oneness with the divine through the heart because it's the easiest way to get to the divine, but also in knowledge. But that knowledge which is not fulfilled in love is missing something. So knowledge which is filled with love but which is not enacted in life is also missing something. So the crying need remains in all of spiritual practice to bring this recognition of the universal divine into our actual daily patterns of life. Two, divinize matter. Two, discover the divine at the base of creation, just as we discover it at the peaks of creation. So I know that I've run a little long, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.